It's good to be back. It was really strange for us not being here with y'all last week. As some of you know, Marion and I took our boys to the first week-long vacation that we've had, at least since the effect's been in effect. So 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, something like that, right, honey? It's been a long time. So it was good to get away. It was good to just take some time, but it was also very strange. We went up to Oregon. And Marion has relatives up there. She was there just last April for her nephew's wedding and just got kind of reacquainted with the place and reacquainted with her cousins and the family up there. And so when we were trying to decide where we were going to go, it was kind of a natural for her to want to come up and show us Oregon. Problem is that our oldest son is deathly afraid of heights and won't fly. He's also not really good at long car drives, and neither is our 7-year-old. So you put those two things together, and we're kind of limited. He's got like a 100-mile radius tether here on us of where we can actually go. So we made the decision to take the train. How many of you have taken any long train rides in here? A few of you? Okay, so you know. I've had so many people ask me, how was a train ride? Would you recommend it? And I said, well, that depends. Depends on your temperament, most of all. It was 30 hours each way on the train, and we did get a sleeper car, so we had a place to sleep, but I'm telling you, these train compartments are a study in the use of space. Everything is miniaturized. Everything is this narrow. You can't exactly walk straight down a corridor. You have to kind of sideways it, and bold beds filled out of walls, Murphy style, and all these strange things. Sinks are literally, you know, as big as a paperback book. It was just a real interesting experience being on the train for that long. And we were going up there to stay with Pauline, who is Marion's cousin that she grew up with and is known, you know, forever, and stay at her place. And she has what's basically a trailer, a modular home, right on the main highway that runs from Seaside along the coast up to Astoria and into Washington State. And she's a hairstylist, so her little salon is another modular right on the same property, and so it was all very compact. And it was just interesting to be able to stay with her and to kind of get to know her better. I mean, Marion knows her so well, but I didn't really know her that well. We got to Portland 30-some hours later. I think the train was a couple hours late. And the next day, Pauline and her sister came to pick us up and to take us back to Seaside, which is about 2 hours away on the coast. And they got there a little bit late because they got misplaced, got lost in all the one-way streets in downtown Portland. And as soon as we headed out of town, promptly the brakes went out, started smoking and doing all kinds of weird stuff. So we got stuck in Beaverton. And had to wait for her son to drive all the way from Seaside back out to pick us up. So we ended up in what amounted to a bar, which they weren't too thrilled having a 7-year-old in. You know, just having Cokes and waiting to be rescued while arrangements were made for a tow truck to tow the car all the way back. When we finally did get back to Seaside and get to her house, she finds out the toilet was broken in what was going to be Marion and my room. And it was just a series of things. And through it all, Pauline just laughed. She couldn't find her way in the streets of Portland. And when she got to us, she was just giggling and laughing. When the car broke down, she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. But, you know, and then she would laugh again. And then come to find out when the toilet is wrong, you know, and this and that. And then she tells us that the day before she had a blood transfusion where they had to basically replace about half of her body's blood and that she almost died. And she laughed about that, too. It was amazing to watch her navigate through all these things that were trying my patience, you know, and just to see how she did this. And I know enough about Pauline's life to know now that her life is difficult. She got married at 19, and she married a high school sweetheart. They had a son right away, and then she found out that he was having an ongoing affair, and when she called him on it, he didn't want to give up the marriage, but he didn't want to give up the affair either. And so she had to leave him, turned herself into a single mom with all the financial hardships that that entailed, struggling through, trying to make it with her son and do all the things that she needed to do. Met another man in church, a good Christian man, you know, married him, had a daughter by him, and then promptly he fell apart. And that was even more of a nightmare than the first one, with all sorts of abuse and all sorts of crazy things going on in that relationship. And so she left him for her daughter's sake and her son's sake. So here she is again, a single mom. She puts herself through cosmetology school, gets a license, and so she can cut hair and start to support herself, and slowly works her way up to where she can buy a little piece of land and put this modular house on it that she spent $18,000 on 18 years ago. So she's gotten her use out of it now. It's been a difficult life. And each time that things came up, you know, in our experience, our week with her, she was able to just deal with it with such grace. And she was teaching me something at that point. The second night that we were there, we were supposed to have a barbecue with her son and his new wife. He was the one who got married, Alex, that Marion went up to the wedding last April. And I thought we were going to their house because they live in town. Turns out we were going to the property that he owns right next to his father, Pauline's ex, where they are going to build a house, but there's no house there right now. It's Oregon. It's raining, you know, and we are actually in the big tool shed, the big vehicle shed with the roll-up doors, and he has a big piece of plywood set out as a table, and so that's our barbecue, and we're making hamburgers and doing this and that, and he wants to show us the land. He wants to show us, you know, everything that's going on, and he's really proud because he's doing well. You know, he's able at 29, 28 to buy land and to start to build a house. And he's so excited to show us. We take this little walk through the wilderness because we're going to go see his cattle. He's got some cattle that he owns with his father because his land is adjacent to his father's. But the cattle weren't on his side. They're on the other side. So we take a drive over to his father's place. Now, imagine this. You know, we're all together here, Pauline in tow, to go visit her ex and to see if we can find the cattle. We knock on the door, and he comes out with his wife, now of, I think, 18 years, who is a lovely person, and their son, and we're all standing there together, and we're talking and laughing, and we find the cattle, and then he promptly comes out with a quad and takes us on a ride throughout all his property, and we're going, you know, ducking branches and doing all this stuff. And we're having a really good time, and then flash on, how's Pauline doing with this, you know? And she's laughing and just seems to be doing fine, you know. When we were getting in the car and going home, someone made the comment, I don't know if it was Marion or Sylvia, Pauline's sister, or both of them together, that, gee, Pauline, if you had played your cards right, all of that could have been yours. All of that acreage, all of that, you know, could have been yours as well. And I was thinking about that. That's true. Life could have been so much easier if somehow she could have stayed with her first husband, who eventually did very well and has a business of his own and has all this property and all this land. But who would she have been? When I got her permission to tell this story publicly to you all, I mentioned that, and she nodded her head and she says, yeah. How would that have changed who she is now if she hadn't gone through all of that? See, we are so focused on outcomes. We are so focused on the things that we put out there. We want to have house. We want to have hearth and land and the right job and retirement and all these things that we miss the process that we need to go through to get to those things. And it's the process that makes us who we are as we get to whatever it is that we get to. Would Pauline have been the kind of person who could laugh when the car breaks down, when you get lost, when the toilet breaks, when you have to have a blood transfusion and you're facing, you know, certain death that you didn't even know was coming your way 2 days earlier? Would she have been the same person? Could she have done that? What is coming to be more and more and more, and the train ride was like a metaphor for this, is that life is process. It's all process. We're made of process. We focus on outcome. We focus on event. We focus on these things, these goals, these plans for ourselves. But what our lives really are is process. How would it change your life if you could really realize that your life is made of process and not outcome? Anything that you have, If it's made of plastic, if it's made of steel, or if it's made of gold, the thing that it's made of is going to change your attitude toward it. Change your attitude and change your use of that thing, whatever it is, whatever it's made of. Can we get to a place where we can realize that we're made of process? Where the things that we tend to jump over, the things that we tend to wish away, the things that we want to avoid, see them as the integral part of who we are. And how would that change things? Now, I don't want to leave you the impression that Pauline's a saint or anything. She'd be the first one to dispel that notion. In fact, on the way home, as they were talking about, oh, this could have been yours, Pauline. You know, I heard a few choice words back there. I think two-timer and loser were in the mix back there as she was talking about her ex. But even that was said with just kind of a tongue-in-cheek, good-natured, lightheartedness. She's become good friends with him. Standing in her bathroom, she has written on the mirror with a magic marker all the things that she is going after, you know, financial security, health, losing weight. She has these things on her so that they're right in front of her every morning so she can pray over them. So it's not that she doesn't have goals. It's not that she isn't looking at those things. But she has found a way to love the process. She's found a way not to get so lost in the things that she's still lacking that she projects out into the future for, that she can't laugh right now, even in the face of things that are difficult. Now, for me, I wasn't doing so well. I got to be honest with you. This is the first week that we've taken off in so long, and, you know, as things go, it was probably the worst week that we could have left with everything that's going on, with all the things that are coming up, and looked at Marion and said, you know, any week would be the worst week. So we're going for it. We're planning it. We're doing it. So I worked real hard the week before to try to get the big things done so that I could really try to just focus on the here and now when I was in the train and on vacation. And Marion was really worried about me because she didn't know if I could do it and would I really be able to relax? Would my mind be over here on all these things? And I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to really work on this. I'm going to be present. And, you know, on a train, 60 hours on a train, it's supposed to have Wi-Fi. You know, I can read. I can catch up on some blogging and some writing. There's just a couple of things that I need to do during the week. I can get those done. No matter what Amtrak tells you, there's no Wi-Fi on a train. Good Lord. Of all the train cars there were, there's one car that actually was supposed to be wired for Wi-Fi. It never worked except, I think, once for 10 minutes. You know, they're going in and out of tunnels and all this stuff. What was I thinking? There's no Wi-Fi, you know? There's no TV. There's no news. There's no anything. You know, you are really cut off. And so I'm sitting there on the way when I finally realized there's going to be no Wi-Fi. I'm not going to be able to check anything. I'm not going to be able to do the things I was planning on doing. You know, it started to work me. Then we get there, and the train breaks down, and the toilet breaks down. And guess what? Pauline has no Wi-Fi. Pauline doesn't even have a computer. We went to a museum where she was supposed to use a mouse to do one thing. She didn't know how to use a mouse. You know, she's 49. Doesn't know how to use a mouse. She lives in a very different reality. She lives in a very different kind of space. It's like the entire vacation was dedicated to frustrating my goals. It couldn't have been planned more perfectly if I had tried to do it. You know, like I said about a train, the temperament, it's like the train itself is from another time. No, you don't go there to get someplace fast. You go there to really just be a part of the process of rolling down these tracks like people have been doing for hundreds of years, looking out at the scenery sliding by out the window. You know, basically what you do on an Amtrak is you sit there and wait for them to call you to the next meal. I mean, that's really what's going on. And so we'd go from our car to the dining car and we'd sit down and go. But, you know, I was taking my computer with me every time thinking maybe there'll be Wi-Fi this time. At one time I asked the steward, you know, could he try to go reset the modem, which he did, and it worked for about 10 minutes and then it was back out again, you know. And then getting to Pauline's and the same thing, you know, I realized what I was doing while I was doing it, but I couldn't quite break through right off the bat. It took me a couple of days, maybe three out of our 7-8, but I finally started getting with the program. I finally started to settle down, and I hope Marion saw the difference in me, because she was real worried about me the first couple of days. You all right? honey, you okay? You doing all right? Yeah, I'm doing fine. And I wasn't doing fine, but I got fine. The whole experience, being so cut off from all the things that I normally do, to live in a different space. People on trains are different than people who fly. They're there because they want to be there. It's a different kind of reality. Spend a lot of time talking with the stewards and getting off at every stop where they allowed you to stretch your legs and talking to the people just out on the platform. I started to get into the spirit of this thing and just realized there's another way to live a process without the constant looming outcome changing the experience of what it's supposed to be. And it was amazing. When the student is ready, the teacher appears, and the teachers were showing up in droves to me, you know. Everything was conspiring to try to break through to my consciousness that there was a different way that I needed to live this thing. There's another case in point. Can I not worry about getting my next thought out? Not be distracted. You go for it, girl. No worries. You know? What was disappointing to me was that as evolved as I thought I was, I am still so tied to these outcomes, to these goals, to accomplishing something, to getting things done. And I preach up here every week to you about living life with a different mindset in a different way. And I'm here to tell you, it's a hard thing to do sometimes. Everything is working against us. The way that we've been raised, the way that we've been taught, the way that society works, the way the world works. There are no free lunches. We need to work for the things that we get in this life. That's okay. But we're looking for a balance here. We're looking for a way to do the things that we need to do, to be responsible, to get where we need to go in life, to take care of our dependents, and yet at the same time, not completely obliterate the process that is our lives. To try to change the whole notion of why we're here. We're not here to accomplish things. We are not here to build things. We're not here to leave any kind of visible legacy. I'm slowly getting this into my brain. What we're here to do is to steep, to immerse, to soak in a reality of God's love that changes us slowly from the inside out and makes us the kind of people who can respond, who can connect, who can be present to this moment as if it were the only thing that existed or mattered, because it is the only thing that exists or matters. Now, did Jesus talk about these things? You bet. You know, I put a few verses together that I'd like to read with you just quickly. I could have picked dozens and dozens more. Everything that Jesus was about was kingdom, which is this process we're talking about. At Mark 8:34, he summons the crowd with his disciples, and he says to them, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" What does it profit for Pauline to have all of that land and all of that ease if it changes who she is? The ability to laugh in the face of things that go wrong. Jesus is saying it's not about outcomes. It's about this thing called soul. Nafsha in Aramaic. And nafsha could literally be translated the breath of life. It is the animation that God breathes into us that gives us everything that we are. It's the living out of this breath. It's the constant motion, the in and out of the breathing process. That's what Jesus is referring to here. It's not about the profit, P-R-O-F-I-T. It's not about the outcome, the goal. It's about this process. At Luke 12, he tells them a parable. The land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? Then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And then I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God says to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now, who will own all that you have prepared? It's not about focus away from this moment. It's not about hoarding and storing and continuing to deal with risk, buying more and more extensive and comprehensive insurance policies, putting the bars up on your window, living your life in that mode that is always focused outward and never here, never now, never inward. Jesus is saying you can't live like that and get anything out of life. Live each moment as if it's the only and last moment, because it is the only moment. And it could be the last moment of this particular life. What are we doing when we so devalue the moment that we're in? When in pining for faces and things that are not present, we miss everything that is. Jesus is working so hard here to try to get us to shift our mind, shift our worldview, to shift gears, and to see that we're missing everything. Matthew 6, don't worry then, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But first seek his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. This day, this moment, plenty of stuff to do this day, this moment. We don't need to add in all the stuff that we import from our fears of the past and regrets of the past and worry for the future. This day, this moment, self-contained, perfect, if we just come to it, connect with it. Matthew 18, truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like little children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And here we have our object lesson right here. A child, by the child's very nature, is everything that we're talking about here. Can we emulate that? When you watch children playing in a yard and you contrast that with the way you are at work or you are at play, is there a difference? If there is, what is the difference? And what could be changed for us to be able to move into that kind of mode more and more? Yes, we're adults. Yes, we have things that we have to think about. Yes, we have responsibilities. And yes, it's these two parents that create the umbrella for this child to be as carefree as this little girl is. If they didn't do their job, she couldn't do hers. And yes, we have responsibilities too. But can we find that balance? Can we find that place that allows us to come out and play as children play? Jesus is constantly trying to get us into this mode. But here's the rub. We've been hearing these words, these passages, since we were in Sunday school. Some of you, before you could even barely learn to walk, were getting scriptures read to you to memorize, to learn. Jesus' words are so familiar often that they lack the power to shock us. It's shocking to try to change your worldview. Do you know how much effort it's going to take for you to move from an outcome-based worldview to a process-based worldview? You probably don't even realize how pervasive it is, how much it just rules the way that you go through life and the choices that you make. I had my object lesson. As much as I've been trying to make this shift, to realize I'm still so far from being able to seamlessly do it. Just put me on a train for 30 hours and see what happens. So what I wanted to do this morning is to read you some stories from another tradition, a Chinese tradition. And whenever I do this, I tend to get in trouble. Look, I'm not trying to convert you into being Taoist or Buddhist or anything. These words here are saying exactly what Jesus was saying. If he were here right now hearing this, his head would be going up and down and he'd be smiling ear to ear and he'd say, yes, preach it. Amen. That's it. You know? All I'm trying to do is to see if by looking at the same issue from another point of view, it can start to tweak something. It can start to lever in, break up some soil, to see if we can start to look at our lives in a different way. There is an old story about a Chinese farmer who had a son and a horse. One day the farmer's horse ran away and all the neighbors were trying to commiserate with the farmer on how unfortunate a circumstance it was that his horse ran away. The old farmer just said, "Could be good, could be bad." The next day the horse came home with four mares following it, and all the neighbors were rejoicing at the farmer's unexpected wealth, whereas the farmer said, "Could be good, could be bad." The next day the farmer's son, while trying to ride one of the new mares, was kicked and his leg was broken. And all the neighbors began again to commiserate with such an unfortunate circumstance. The old farmer replied, "Could be good, could be bad." And the next day, the commanding general of the local army came into the village and took all the young, able-bodied men. They were all drafted into the army and marched off to fight the war, except, of course, the farmer's son, who had a broken leg. Rejoicing with obvious mixed feelings about the farmer's son being the only son remaining in the village, the villagers congratulated the farmer on his good fortune, and the farmer, of course, replied, "Could be good, could be bad." With the outcomes that we seek come the expectations we have for those outcomes. It's the expectations that kill us. What do we expect out of something when that is not met? As I said before, the space between our expectation and our experience is all the room we need to be completely miserable. Can we start to live our lives by seeing everything coming at us? Like those candies in that Lucy episode coming down the conveyor belt. Just deal with it as it comes up. Wrap it, let it go, take the next one. Stop trying to look down the conveyor belt, but just be here. Be now. There are so many things that we can't control. We cannot control the outcomes. We don't even know what the outcomes are going to be. When something happens that looks like it could be good, and then it turns and it moves in a different direction, what control do we have over that? Just let the things, the moments, come down the belt. Deal with them as they come. And when the difficult ones come, can we, like Pauline, still laugh? Still move with grace through those moments and let things go on. You know, there was one night, the last night that we had dinner together, Pauline's sister made goulash because they're a good German family. And at one point she announced to everyone that there was French bread to go with the goulash. And Alex, Pauline's son, new bride, Bethany, she looks at Alex, she says, "Ooh, French bread. We'll start tomorrow." The implied diet that they were going on could wait in the face of the French bread. How do we approach certain things like diets? We're going on a diet. If the outcome is to lose 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 30, 40 pounds, we're weighing ourselves every day. And we're doing all the things that we need to do in order to get to that goal. And if we're not getting there fast enough, what is the experience of our life? What is the way in which we approach our food? How good does that food taste when we feel like we're being denied in order for this outcome, this goal that's out there someplace? Is there another way that we can approach a diet? Can we start to simply impose, maybe impose is the wrong word, lay down a new lifestyle? It's different than the other one, but it's self-contained. It has its own pleasures. And we forget about the goal. We forget about the outcome, the number of pounds. We don't weigh ourselves every day. And when French bread is on the table, we'll start tomorrow. Can we do that? Is there another way that we can approach these things? People have come to me and told me that they're really nervous about a job interview that's coming up and how they're going to approach it. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. The worst thing that you can do is go into that interview worrying about whether you're going to get hired or not. Because people can smell you sweat. People can smell your desperation. If you can just go into an interview just to have a conversation with another human being who's sitting on the other side of a desk, walk in there thinking, how can I make their day better? How can I leave them better than they found them? How would that change your experience of the interview? How would it allow you to be present, to look that person right in the eye, not as someone way above you who's holding the keys to your future, but just another person that you're talking to and trying to leave better than you found them? Ironically, it's the best chance you'll have at getting that job, because you will be confident and you will be who you are. And people like to hire people they feel comfortable with. Can we turn that thing around? I remember when I was sitting on the other side of the desk and I was a director of communications for a healthcare firm and I was hiring people. You know, I just wanted to have as much fun as I could through a terrible process. You get stacks of resumes that you have to go through and you have to parse and then you're interviewing people. It's a long, arduous process. If someone came in and made me smile, made me laugh, that's the person I remembered. I once brought someone in on an interview simply because he signed his name EW squared. His name was Edward Wilson Weber or something like that. I just thought that was so cool. EW squared. Showed some personality. Showed that he was having some fun with his life. I brought him in just to see. He didn't get the job. Sorry, but he got the interview at least. Is that something that we can do? I've told the story here before about Matt Pack, who came in and said, you know, there's this girl I really like, but I just can't talk to her. I just lose it. You know, I always say stupid things. I can't think, you know. And yet girls that I'm not interested in, I can talk to, you know, just fine. No problem. Do you know why? No, I really don't. It's because you're already picking out curtains with her. You're already way down the road trying to figure out how this is going to end. You can't be present. This is what outcomes do to us. The focus on outcomes destroy our ability to just live the present moment. Chuang Tzu, one of the founders of Taoism, if you haven't read any Chuang Tzu, I just entirely endorse him. He comes at Jesus' truth just from a slightly different perspective that changes everything. Listen to what he writes here. When an archer is shooting for fun, he has all his skill. If he shoots for a brass buckle, he is already nervous. If he shoots for a prize of gold, he goes blind or sees two targets. He is out of his mind. His skill has not changed, but the prize divides him. He cares. He thinks more of winning than of shooting. And the need to win drains him of power. Is there another way to be able to approach that? You know, sometimes we say it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game, you know? Yeah, but that's always spoken by the losers, right? Of course they're going to say that. But can we start to see what we do as that process? Can we do something for the love of the game? Can we shoot at a target because it just feels good? We love to watch the perspective of that arrow leaping forth and finding its way to the target. Can we do whatever we do just for the love of doing it and let the outcomes fend for themselves? I've told you before, but the biggest illustration of this in my life is that this time, just in the last few years, is the first time that I've really enjoyed playing music. All my life, music was a means to an end. I wanted to be a songwriter. I wanted to be a producer. I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to be this and that. And every time at bat was an attempt to further that goal. Where was this going to lead? Who was going to hear this? Who was going to be able to open this door or that door? How did this all work? Nervous. Divided. Now, finally, at this stage in my life, I'm not going to be a rock star anymore. I've made peace with that. To be able to sit up here and just play for no other reason, not leading anywhere but this moment, to get lost in the music myself for the chance that you might be able to do the same, is the most liberating thing that I've experienced in years. And those anchor points of my week are what, to a large extent, allow me to be able to keep re-experiencing this process as opposed to outcome. Chuang Tzu again, if a man steps on a stranger's foot in the marketplace, he makes a polite apology and offers an explanation. This place is so crowded. If an elder brother steps on his younger brother's foot, he says sorry, and that is that. If a parent steps on his child's foot, nothing is said at all. The greatest politeness is free from all formality. Perfect conduct is free of concern. Perfect wisdom is unplanned. Perfect love is without demonstrations, and perfect sincerity offers no guarantee. I love that. It's pointing to a letting go of this imagined control. Jesus says you can't turn one hair white or black on your head. What is it that you think you really control? What is it you think you can really do here? Let it go. Perfect love requires no demonstrations. Perfect wisdom is unplanned. Can we just allow ourselves to just be to the extent that all these things take care of themselves? Can we change our perspective to that degree? The man of God acts without impediment. He harms no other being by his actions. Yet he does not know himself to be kind or gentle. Did you get that? He acts without impediment. He harms no other being by his actions. Yet he does not know himself to be kind or gentle. He doesn't think of himself that way. He does not struggle to make money, and he does not make a virtue of poverty. He goes without relying on others and does not pride himself on walking alone. The man of God remains unknown. Perfect virtue produces nothing. Perfect virtue produces nothing. No self is the true self, and the greatest man is nobody. This is a hard one. This is a weird one. Because it's easier for us to see that our failings can harm relationships and harm connections. Being bad, quote unquote, separates us. But can we also start to see that being good can separate as well? Can you start to see how that works? That as soon as you take virtue, as soon as you take your good deeds and you turn them into outcomes, you turn them into goals, you turn them into this objective thing outside of yourself that you need to go for and strive for and do, you've turned it into non-virtue. You've created another thing out there that needs to be done that takes you away from the only thing that you can do, which is to be right here and right now, flowing seamlessly through your life. If we can do that, if we can seek first the kingdom and flow through life, we will do these good things without even realizing what we're doing. We're just who we are. But as soon as we make them this thing, we've lost it. Our virtue, our goodness, is a byproduct of living this process we're talking about. Chuang Tzu, with his bamboo pole, was fishing the Pu River. The Prince of Chu sent two vice chancellors with a formal document. "We hereby appoint you prime minister." Chuang Tzu held his bamboo pole still. Watching the Pu River, he said, "I am told there is a sacred tortoise offered and canonized 3,000 years ago, venerated by the prince, wrapped in silk in a precious shrine on an altar in the temple. What do you think? Is it better to give up one's life and leave a sacred shell as an object of cult in a cloud of incense for 3,000 years, or to live as a plain turtle dragging his tail in the mud?" "For the turtle," said the vice chancellor, "better to live and drag its tail in the mud." "Go home," said Chuang Tzu. "Leave me here to drag my tail in the mud." Why do we seek fame? Why do we seek achievement and accomplishment? What does it mean? When is it better just to be, to drag your tail in the mud, to be okay in your own skin, to stop yearning for something else, for something other than what you have right now? For a little bit different perspective from Paul Coelho's blog, "A friend came to wait on our table at a cafe in San Diego," he writes. "I had met Claudia in Brazil 4 years previously, and tell my friends about her life in the USA. She only sleeps for 3 hours since she works in this cafe till late and is a babysitter throughout the day. I don't know how she can stand it," one of the women at our table said. "There's a Buddhist story about a turtle," replies an Argentinian woman at our table. "The turtle was crossing a swamp covered in mud when it passes a temple. There it saw the shell of another turtle, all adorned with gold and precious stones. 'I don't envy you, ancient friend,' thought the turtle. 'You're covered in jewels, but I am doing what I want.'" There was a porter in our car named Gabriel, and I got to know him pretty well in 30 hours. You know, I would go out the platform every chance I got, and we would talk. And in the course of our talking, he told me that he had been working for Amtrak for 8 years as a steward, and before that, 10 years as a flight attendant. So he kind of went from planes to trains. And he said he loves the train so much more. He was in his mid-30s. Broad smile every time I saw him. You know what his life is like on the train? Is simply cleaning up after everything that we mess up. He's constantly cleaning restrooms because they're always getting messed up on a train. You know, things bouncing around. Stuff is splashing all over the place in there. He's constantly cleaning that up. He's looking after everybody's needs. He's up and down these stairs. He gets 4 hours of sleep, maybe five, for each 24 that he works. And he loves what he does. I'm thinking, how can you stand this? You know, but he loves it. And you should have seen that he reacted to everybody. He knew everybody. He knew particulars about them. Oh, I love her. She's great. I said, well, is she a regular on the train? No, this is her first time. But he already knew her, and he loved her, and he thought she was great. You know, we're standing on the platform at Santa Barbara. Oh, isn't this just the most beautiful place? Everything was the most beautiful place. He loved what he was doing. Now, the steward on the parlor car was another issue. You know, I went up to him because I wanted to find out if there was a movie. Because there were movies that were playing, and I didn't see the placard. And he just looks at me and he points. Oh, there it is over there. I missed it. I'm sorry. Then I wanted to know if there would be any news in between the movies because, you know, stuff's going on. And he said, no news. Then, of course, I had asked the question about Wi-Fi again. And I said, you know, the steward before was able to reset it. Would you be able to reset it? He goes, I've been doing this for 14 years. I wouldn't tell you something that's not true. You know, I was told in no uncertain terms, don't bug me. I'm thinking, you've been on here for 14 years. I've been on here for 14 hours. Don't mess with me, man. Well, it's the difference between the two. Gosh, could there have been a starker contrast? You know, Gabriel would light up the hallways, the corridors. You know, every time I saw him, we had another conversation. It was a wonderful experience being around him. He's just dragging his tail in the mud. He's doing what he does, and he loves it. I don't think there's really anything going in his career on Amtrak, but he loves what he's doing. There was a man who was so disturbed by the sight of his own shadow and so displeased with his own footsteps that he determined to get rid of both. The method he hit upon was to run away from them, so he got up and ran. But every time he put his foot down, there was another step, while his shadow kept up with him without the slightest difficulty. He attributed his failure to the fact that he was not running fast enough, so he ran faster and faster without stopping until he finally dropped dead. He failed to realize that if he merely stepped into the shade, his shadow would vanish, and if he sat down and stayed still, there would be no more footsteps. Have any of you ever been in a hot air balloon? I know I've used this before, too. First time I went, I thought it would be breezy, wind blowing all over the place, and I got up there, and it was as still as sitting in this room. As sitting in your living room, and I couldn't figure out until I realized we're being pushed by the wind, same direction and speed. This is what happens when we can finally start to get in sync with our lives, to just be pushed by the wind, to let things go where they're supposed to go. Sometimes you hear that you're supposed to take only memories and leave only footsteps. The ideal here in Chuang Tzu's philosophy is that you don't even leave footsteps. You don't even leave footprints. That your passage through life leaves no evidence because you are moving with the flow of everything that is. And things change when you do that. We've been going through Brother Lawrence's Practicing the Presence of God. And Wednesday night, we read one paragraph and that was it. That was 2 weeks ago. One paragraph took us through an hour and a half of discussion. This was the paragraph. Brother Lawrence had always been guided by love without any other self-interest. And he did not worry about whether he would be damned or saved. I want to read that again. He did not worry whether he would be damned or saved. The goal of all his actions was to do them for the love of God. He found great satisfaction in doing this. He was even content to pick up one single straw from the ground for the love of God. He looked for God alone and for nothing else. Brother Lawrence had found a way to be so involved in process that he didn't even care if he was going to heaven or hell. Because in another passage he says, even if he went to hell, his practice of God's presence would turn hell into a paradise. How do you get there? You know, 2 weeks ago when I spoke, Pastor Frank told me afterwards that he had talked to a couple of people, and they were a bit dismayed by the message because they said that I was setting an impossible standard that could not be matched. How in the world can you do these things? And I don't know what you're thinking about what I'm saying right now, but it may seem to you that these are impossible standards, that you can't do these things. Don't worry about that. Some days you will be able to break through and be present and be right where you need to be. And other days, like me on the train, you just won't be able to quite get there. But if this is our goal, if this is where we want to be, more and more often we will get there. More and more often until we hit 51%, just 51%, more often than not, characterized by living process instead of outcome, our lives will completely change. It's all about the balance. Yes, we need to plan. Yes, we need to look forward. And yes, we need to take stock of the past, but never at the expense of the present. We're made of process. We can't wish it away. One more story to close. He who rules men lives in confusion. He who is ruled by men lives in sorrow. Desire therefore neither to influence others nor to be influenced by them. The way to get clear of confusion and free of sorrow is to live with God in the land of the great void. If a man crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he is a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing, and all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not angry. If you can empty your own boat, crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will seek to harm you. The straight tree is the first to be cut down. The spring of clear water is the first to be drained dry. If you wish to improve your wisdom and shame the ignorant, to cultivate your character and outshine others, a light will shine around you as if you had swallowed the sun and the moon. You will not avoid calamity. A wise man has said, "He who is content with himself has done a worthless work. Achievement is the beginning of failure. Fame is the beginning of disgrace. Who can free himself of achievement and fame, then descend and be lost amidst the masses of men? He will flow like spirit, unseen. He will go about like life itself, with no name and no home. Simple is he, without distinction. To all appearances, he is a fool. His steps leave no trace. He has no power. He achieves nothing. He has no reputation. Since he judges no one, no one judges him. Such is the perfect man. His boat is empty." It's all process. It's not outcome. If we're not seeking external things as objects, but continually becoming, we're approaching where Jesus is trying to take us. In our weakness, we are made strong. And in our emptiness, we are filled. Let's pray. Father, help me. Help all of us. It's so difficult for us to learn these things. So difficult to change the way that we live. Help us to have a desire for something different, a desire for a different way to approach you, to experience you and each other. Often we know that there's something missing. Often we know that something is wrong, something is eating at us, but we don't know what it is and we don't know how to do something different. Help us to realize in this moment is where we can find those answers, where we can find you. Thank you for loving us the way that you do, Lord. Take us, guide us, mold us, allow us to be taken and guided and molded in our lives this day and every day. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.